Well, how big is your lab, and how well have you been able to attract good work, postdocs and grad students?
Mm-hmm. So right now I have one technician, two graduate students, and two postdocs, and that's about a good size. I have one graduate student, and she and she's been with me a little bit over 2 years, and she's my first student. That was a little discouraging. I thought I would attract a graduate student sooner than that. You know, being an ex-graduate student recently and an overall nice guy and you know, being well liked by the people in the department, and so it was a little discouraging that students just didn't flock to my lab. Not that they didn't flock, but they didn't even come for rotations, which was kind of so. But I guess the reasoning was, or the way I reason it is, that I was sort of an unknown quantity and quality about, in terms of, can I lead a graduate student successfully in a PhD dissertation, whereas the other faculty members are experienced and were proven. So if you're a student faced with the likely faced with having to spend 5, 6, 7 years in the pursuit of a PhD, you kind of want to make sure that it's going to get done. And best put your money on the ones that have done it in the past. But now I have two. Okay. I've been very, very fortunate in technicians. But we're in a... this is a real plus for this area, that there are lots of good universities, undergraduate universities in this area. And then lots of... And in addition to lots of good universities in this area, there's a lot of good students who are in this limbo between undergraduate degree and figuring out what they're going to do with respect to their rest of their life, with respect to the rest of their life between medical school and graduate school, trying to decide. So they're going to think about it for a couple years, and they're usually going to get a job as a technician, and they're bright because they're obviously candidates to go to medical school and graduate school. So it's not difficult to attract a good quality technician. Now, what's difficult is to keep them for longer than about 2 or 3 years, but that you just accept that. So I've had three technicians that have been very good, and they've moved on, but they've been productive and helped me quite a bit. Postdoc, I had a disappointing incident with my first one. She came and worked for a year, and I asked for a 2-year commitment, like I do with technicians. And at the end of the first year, she announced that she had applied to medical school and was going to go, and just ignored the commitment that she had made to me. And she was doing very, very well too, and had accomplished something that one other technician and myself had been unsuccessful at separately. And she succeeded. So she left, and that was discouraging. But I have two postdocs now. And one of them has required a little bit more attention to get started, but you know, I kind of figured that, and I was ready to do that. But he's progressing very nicely, and I think he's easily already made this. Has already been productive enough that he's paid back the time that I've spent and put into him. And Xu Pin, the Chinese fella, the only time I spent with him is for him to tell me what he's done and then to make me understand what he's done and tell me where I go read about so I can learn what he's doing. And I think he'll work out very, very well. As I mentioned the other day, I just hope that, you know, that I know that we'll be successful in cloning this gene, and I hope he stays around to clone the next one. And then after that, that he finds a rewarding position, justifiable based on his contributions. So it was slow attracting graduate students, but I've got two, and that's fine. And I haven't had any problem with technicians and had an initial bad experience with the postdoc, but I'm very well pleased now. Overall, been very fortunate.
Well, we were talking about this yesterday, both on tape and off tape, at the end of the last session. And, you know, we've talked a lot about hierarchies in lab, and you mentioned yesterday that, you know, you think that there's so many graduate students and so many postdocs and not enough PI positions. And then you have this you yourself were a research associate who then, you know, who was clearly capable of doing independent research, but then kind of hit a ceiling where there was, you know, a need for PhD, not that scientifically you needed a PhD, but, you know, administratively you needed a PhD. And then you have this postdoc, this Chinese postdoc, who's absolutely superb and is making, you know, huge contributions, but his time is limited. And you know, if he goes back to China, his the quality of his research because of the setting in China may be wasted. And yet, is there a PI position for him? And then what you just said about, you know, you're a good scientist, but you're doing desk work. So is there some way to rethink how, you know, laboratory science is structured in terms of who does what? So that everybody gets to do, the people who aren't good scientists do who are good administrators, or, you know, grant writers, or, you know, teachers, or whatever, or do that, and the scientists do the science. And, you know, I don't know if that means inflating or deflating degrees, or, you know, what the options are. How do you see this?
Well, as we talked a little bit yesterday, you know, I think there's a real glut of postdocs, and in scientific language, the rate limiting step is progressing past the level of postdoc into whether it's faculty positions in an academic setting or principal investigator in a biotech. I mean, that's, everything is getting backed up right there because there's just not that many. But yet the system is producing more postdocs. So the pool is getting larger and larger, which means that those that are in there are going to get less likely to get out. So that it just seems that there ought to be that we need to do something to deplete, to make that pool smaller, to move these people into productive, rewarding careers that were kind of promised them back when they started down the path towards scientific research. You know, if you do well in graduate school, you do well in a postdoc, then there's going to be a good job for you. Not a great job, but you're going to be able to do things that you'd learned how to do well, and that you'd be paid for them. And that's just not the case here. So what are we going to do? Well, one thing is that I think we ought to stop making more graduate students or reduce that flow. We're trying to do a little bit of that here. But at the same time, what are there positions that we can create to help relieve this roadblock? And it probably won't occur at the level of faculty members in universities, because they're actually getting smaller. A good place would be in biotechnology. And I guess I don't know the economics that well, but I'm sure that it comes about as a result of just the expansion of that industry. And what's preventing it from being expanding is, I don't know, maybe the application of some basic research or that's has it come about? Are less government control and control over, say, drug processing and development? Maybe, you know, creating research institutions that are both federally and privately funded, sort of cooperatives like some of the universities have done around here, to not so much have contract type research, but just mutual agreements to facilitate the flow of information from basic research and into perhaps an applied setting. And then it just seems like that to help the principal investigator in the academic lab, and this is actually an idea that I heard from Ed a long time ago, and as I think more about it, I agree with him 100%, that there ought to be ways to fund lieutenants in laboratories, and lieutenants could be filled by these senior level postdocs, to where they have a stable position that's partially on hard money as opposed to continuously being dependent upon grants for support, but that either through the university or through the federal government or some agency, just to have some of this money go into a pool that is large enough to fill these hard money positions. So you could have a postdoc working with an established investigator or a professor, say, on laboratories the size of 7 or greater. And part of his responsibility, this lieutenant, is that he can not only do laboratory bench work, but he can maybe help a little on the teaching load, you know, maybe in the form of study groups or advanced TAing. The principal investigator can elicit his help in reviewing papers that the lieutenant has an expertise on, so it's sort of like a second level of review. Field questions from other collaborators or other people in the area that, you know, call me and ask for advice or information about my project or what's going on. You know, just the day-to-day exchange of information. If I could direct a call to Greg Warner, you know, feel confident that I know that, you know, and he could answer the questions. That way, take a little bit of time away from my desk work and allow me to get back in the lab, but yet give him some responsibility, but at this and a more stable environment financially, then that would be something I think could be admirable and help kind of relieve this backlog in the academic field now. In biotechnology, it's just, I guess, the expansion of the industry. But if I was a postdoc now, I mean, I'd be pretty scared. If I was a graduate student, I'd be pretty scared. In fact, if I was a graduate student, and I usually try to encourage our students that, you know, unless you're just really 100% sure that you want to be a university professor, then you ought to begin to think about postdocing in biotech. Because it's not the best the best case scenario, because there's a lot of creation and destruction in jobs in that industry. You know, there's companies that are bought up and sold and projects that are dissolved and people are laid off. But it might be, in the long run, for a postdoc or whatever, more stable than this.
Giving all these constraining factors that have more to do with kind of the structure of science, the infrastructure of science.
Mm-hmm.
how do we maintain kind of the critical levels of our creativity in the next generation and the students and the postdocs that are going to continue to advance scientific knowledge? Take for specifically the Chinese postdoc that you have, who you know, has generated a lot of enthusiasm just because of the environment that he is in now, because of what he didn't have in China, and yet his future may not seem very certain. So how do you, given this environment, how do you still kind of select for kind of the creativity needed to advance science and make scientific discoveries?
I don't know. Let me just think a minute. Actually, why don't you turn the tape off?
Okay.
So I think one way that we can foster or improve or maintain creativity at a high level, if we're committed to do that, is to establish, if they're not already, establish programs that stimulate creativity at the level of, say, senior postdocs before they have to go into a principal investigator position. So the reason I think that is that that's based on history in conventional professional track, that's a time when the individual is probably at its his or her peak in terms of their knowledge basis, their stimulation, their enthusiasm, and hopefully potential creativity, because they just kind of come to the end of their own training, so to speak, or being trained. And they're getting ready to go out on their own. But yet, as soon as they get out on their own, then they have to get into lockstep with the system, which means usually writing a grant that follows a rigid set of guidelines that have to be followed, that being specific aims or whatever. So the opportunity for... And then, unless they have an enormous amount of funding straight off, they're not going to have the flexibility to continue to be test their creativity. So just as soon as you move into a faculty position, you lose that. Now, I know that through agencies like the Pew and the Howard Hughes and the like, then that those individuals who receive those awards do have that opportunity. But is that enough, and does it come at the right time? To me, it seems like that if we could might possibly consider fostering creativity, say, in those last years of postdoc, to those individuals that are deserving or have demonstrated the potential to really move forward. And I think there's some programs like this that, you know, maybe the Pew Fellows program is something similar to this. Are you familiar with that? Mm-hmm. In which there's Latin American postdocs, or I think by and large they're postdocs, have the opportunity to come to the States and receive additional training, but they're in somebody else's lab. And that's more or less a continuation in their training and not so much an opportunity to just really freelance. But I'm sure that there are, in large labs especially, in the Boston area or whatever, that there really are talented, bright postdocs who have demonstrated, say, in the past 3 years of their postdoctoral training as well as their graduate program, that there's a significant potential for this individual to spontaneously develop, so to speak, some technology that would bring genome sequencing 5 years closer. If we just, you know, give him the resources right now when before he has to go out and start earning a living. So I guess a program like that might help utilize the brain power of these people who I think are really at perhaps their peak in terms of experimentation and thoughts. Now, they'll probably be good investigators later on, but then that comes under... But then they have to develop all these other skills like management, letter writing, reviewing, these kind of things. So, but in terms of placing, like Chopin, you know, the postdoc that I have, you know, that's a much more difficult situation. Obviously, if we have a good measure of success, then we'll try to see that he gets a permanent residency in this country, which is mandatory for any sort of permanent position, whether it's in biotechnology or an academic setting. And you know, he might be able to, with continued success, he might be able to get a permanent position, but it puts him into the same category as all these other postdocs and senior postdocs that already exist. And I'm sure that there are lots of Chopins out there, each one of whom could make significant contributions well beyond the time that they're in my lab or wherever they are. But we can't continue to pay them a postdoc salary justifiably. It's just not fair. My salary goes up every year, and theirs will go up a little bit too, but not to compensate for the amount of experience and training that they've had and the productivity that they're delivering. So I once again, I think just had to try to create positions for these people in our profession. At the same time, kind of stop the input, slow it down a little bit. You know, you could almost, and then, how do we slow it down a little bit? Well, if a master's degree was more beneficial than what it is, especially coming from somebody who has one, and I'm not saying it was a mistake to get one. It wasn't for me, and I benefited from it. But I can see that I wouldn't advise anyone to get a master's degree now. If you're not going to pursue a PhD, then you might as well just stick with the baccalaureate. So, but if that was a more meaningful degree or opened up opportunities for students, then they might decide to... We may see more students in those programs than they are taking the PhD challenge. So if there were... And this is where biotechnology certainly employs the lion's share of those master's students that come out now. I don't think you see any master's students in an academic setting. The salary increase for a master's over a baccalaureate, I know at Tufts, it's just not even worth the effort to go to school for the extra time, whether it's a year or 18 months or whatever. But I think biotechnology companies pay a little bit better, so there is some incentive. But if the reward for that academic achievement was better than what it is, then maybe, like I said, it would persuade some students who normally would think about advanced training only at the level of a PhD to maybe just take a master's program, succeed, get into a job, and actually be more productive than they would be trying to flounder around as a principal investigator, especially after spending 6-7 years postdocing. They would get into a position and start making contributions, say, after 2 or 3 years of post-baccalaureate training, i.e. getting a master's, than they would after 12 years of taking a PhD and postdocing, and be just as content without having with a different set of initials after their name. So that doesn't address Chopin, but I haven't got a. I mean, I know there were lots of foreign postdocs that came in and through Dallas. Some went back to their countries and went on to the next level. Some went back and didn't go on to the next level. Some stayed in this country and just continued to move about and postdoc longer, and are still postdocs. And a couple actually were able to get permanent residencies and eventual appointments at universities in the country. So, but that, I think those are rare compared to other foreign nationals that come to this country to postdoc and are in other laboratories. They just end up staying here for as long as they can before they have to go back. We shouldn't stop bringing them here. I think it ought to be open and competitive. We shouldn't limit training and education at any level or at any profession to only people that live on these shores.
And why is that?
Because that just excludes an incredible mass of opportunity and mind power, which just goes against all rules of nature. And we already do that, and our department does that, because we have a training grant, a large NIH training grant, to fund graduate fellowships, and it's restricted only to U.S. citizens or permanent residents. So right now we're trying to figure out how many graduate students we're going to take in the fall of September of 1997. And we know we have 4 training grant slots. But if we want to take a student who's not a permanent resident or a U.S. citizen, then that's going to have to come off of hard money from the university, which is a little bit harder to come by than a training grant. So, and then that means that the budget, you know, something's going to have to be rearranged in the budget to create that fellowship money. So when, as the guy who reviews all these applicants coming to our program, I've got one pile that says U.S. and the other says non-U.S. And they get evaluated differently. We usually end up taking one non-U.S. every year, but sometimes the pile that says non-U.S. is a lot higher caliber than the pile that says U.S. And if you look at the, so we have in the wall of our conference room, there's a picture of every student who has completed our program, and you can, in an objective fashion, rank them, with me being at the top. And those that are in the upper echelon are from mainly China. I'd say the top, out of the top 10, perhaps 6 of them are from China. So less than 60% of the students that have been through our department are from China. But they came and competed very well. So, you know, that we do that anyway, but we shouldn't be doing that, and especially at the level that we're doing it. But, you know, it's tempting because most of the time you can bring in a postdoc and pay them cheaper, pay them less, you know, because they're more willing to come. But you usually end up getting what you pay for. And it doesn't take them long to know that they're not getting, if you're paying them less and they're making less money than Joe Smith from Alabama down the hall, because he's on a training grant or whatever. So they're that's not very good incentive to do well if you know you're getting less money just because you're they can afford to, you know, that they taking advantage of you. So I guess, you could say, well, you could take that step back and step further back and say, well, maybe we ought to do things to really encourage more foreign students to apply to U.S. universities. And then that's going to produce this a dilemma in bringing about more postdocs. But at the same time, if we hold high standards for admittance and high standards for matriculation and eventual degree granting, then the overall, you know, pool is going to be much better.
Do you have opportunities in your lab, or do you encourage opportunities for foreign scholars at whatever level to come into your lab and work for a semester or for a summer? Or?
I have an opportunity to do that, and have done it, and will probably continue to do it. I have a, although it doesn't bring any money into my lab, a United States Israeli Binational Science Foundation grant. And it's a collaborative venture. So the funding is collaborative between the U.S. government and the Israeli government, although I'm told that it's just the money, all the money comes from probably the State Department and then just goes to the Israeli government, who oversees administration of these grants that are written by Israeli investigators. So it's sort of like putting money here, then says, okay, bring it back here. But the stipulation is that you've got to have an active collaboration with an American investigator, but they're just giving all the money to them. So there's a colleague that I guess we started, we've never done any, but prior to this, we've never done any collaborative work. We met at meetings and discussed common intellectual pursuits in science. He's with cholesterol metabolism too, and approaches to problems and his work and my work, and we seem to feed off of each other's ideas and have enjoyed this exchange, you know, just intellectually for a long time. And then he applied for one of these grants and asked me to be the co-investigator, the American cohort to this, and I said sure. So the money is spent mostly for supplies and salary for him, but part of it is for me to travel there and work. So last in May of 95, I went to Israel for 3 weeks and worked in his lab. And then last July, his research associate came over here and worked the whole month in my lab. And I'm supposed to go back there, and I'm supposed to go next month, but I canceled. And I'm not sure when, but probably before the end of the year. And then in the following year, another person from his lab will come over for a month. I mean, I won't go for another 3 weeks. I'll probably go for like 2 weeks. But so we're, you know, and then exchanging personnel, so to speak. So his people come over and learn stuff from my lab, and all I do to go over there is just to help him in his experiments. It's more of a one-way, sort of like the money. It's all going that way, and the information is all going this way. But.
And why do you do that?
Well, I think he's a bright guy, and he has a good experimental system, and it's so he's trying to define genes and their factors which mediate regulated degradation of HMG-CoA reductase, which is the rate-limiting enzyme in cholesterol biosynthesis. So that the level of that protein fluctuates inversely with the level of cholesterol in the cell. So when cells have a lot of cholesterol, there's no need to make it. So the level of the protein goes down. And the converse is true. So that mediating the level of that protein is accomplished by either accelerating or slowing its degradation, how fast it's proteolized. So cholesterol stimulates the proteolysis. The lack of cholesterol slows the proteolysis or increases the stability. So as it turns, so that was something that Faust, Brown, and Goldstein discovered back in about 1980. Yeah. But since then, We don't know anything about the protease that does the clipping. Now, he actually came from Bob Simone's lab, which has made the other significant observation, is that they defined the region in the protein itself that is required for the degradated proteolysis. They made a construct between the membrane spanning regions of HMG-CoA reductase, the N-terminal domain, and hooked it onto somebody else, and it mimicked that. So they kind of defined what part of the protein's involved with it, and that's all that we know. So they don't know anything. We don't know anything about the protease that does it, or the sensing mechanism that the cell uses to say, all right, there's high cholesterol, turn the protease on, or make the protein more susceptible to already existing proteases. Or there's low cholesterol, turn the protease off, whatever it may be, or make it less susceptible to proteolysis. So, you know, I mean, this is 15 years later. We don't know anything more about that. So he set up a system primarily using genetic screens, which is something I like to play with, to define factors that can slow the proteolysis or accelerate it upon command, independent of cholesterol, and then be able to pluck out these factors independently through cloning and identify what they are. So that's an experimentally challenging and intellectually stimulating little project. And it's fun to keep up with it, because I kind of had a history in this, you know. And knowing it hasn't gone forward since then, more or less. So that's working out pretty good. Yeah, it works out good. I guess it could be more of an exchange, but that's the best we can do at this level. And then I have a collaboration on my NCL project. Not a strong collaboration with a guy in New Zealand. And then actually I was thinking about this, and he's got a lot of students. He's at a vet school. See, because not only are there mouse models for this, but there's this disease is very prominent in sheep in New Zealand. You know, there's a lot of inbreeding. And if he just happens to be in an isolated area in which you've got what's called a founder effect, you got, say, one, so when sheep first came to New Zealand, let's say 150 years ago, if in the flock of the first original 100, which probably came from somebody's flock that was inbred to begin with, if that particular population had a high prevalence of this mutation, then now this flock of 100, which in the next 150 years would be 150 million, then you'd have a significant amount of sheep that would get this neurodegenerative problem when they get, you know, up about 2 years old. So NCL is a significant problem to the sheep population in New Zealand. So there's a lot of interest in studying that. Unfortunately, you can't do a lot in terms of molecular genetics on sheep. You can do even less on sheep than you can on man because of the lack of markers and genetic technology is not applied. But still, he has a lot of students. And so I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe one of his students ought to come and into my lab and study NCL in the context of mice or whatever, and spending some pew money to bring him over. So that's something we've discussed. But that, you know, anytime you bring somebody into my lab, then it increases the numbers.
Okay, well, I'm going to jump back a little bit. We're kind of coming to the end of our time, and I wanted to cover a couple of areas. And one, to go back a little bit, is, you know, how, when you became a faculty member here at Tufts, how were you able to shift identities from being a graduate student to being a faculty member at PI?
Well, that wasn't difficult. Mainly because it all occurred in the same department, and I was well accepted. There wasn't any animosity, or there wasn't any ill feelings among other faculty members when I came on board, because why are we bringing on this student to join our ranks? I mean, nobody felt that way. And I didn't have to move anywhere, except just right across the hall. And I knew all the faculty members, and that they could help me set the lab up, you know, answer questions about you know, where to buy things and how to go about setting up a lab. I did a little bit of that at DuPont, although it was kind of partly set up when I got there. So the physically, the transition was smooth. And even support-wise, emotionally, it was smooth because they already knew me, so they could counsel me on writing grants and the like. So it was a lot. In talking to other people that moved from mostly from a postdoc to a faculty position and physically moved and had to meet and become acquainted and make contacts with people in this new department. That takes time, that I just didn't have that. So, and I had other offers. And I wasn't thrilled about staying in Boston because I knew if I stayed, I'd have to stay a long time. Ideally, I would have wanted to go a little bit further south. But the fact that I knew it would be a smooth transition and I wanted to get started and off quickly and in the right direction was a real strong reason to keep the offer here, to take the offer here at Tufts Physiology.
Well, another aspect of your life that we haven't touched upon is a little bit of the personal side. And I wanted to ask, given that you're in this interesting, not so uncommon situation, but definitely not common, that you share your life with a fellow scientist. And not only does she do science, she's in your department, she does similar work here, you've collaborated.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you balance kind of these, and she must be undergoing the same kind of pressures and constraints that you do with funding issues, mm-hmm. and competition and teaching responsibility. And how do you keep your lives balanced, especially when, you're both scientists, and do you go home and talk about science over the dinner table, and how do you kind of maintain separate kind of...
Yeah.
Compartments in your life?
We don't talk science over the dinner table. The only time we talk science outside of the lab is that a couple of times a week if we happen to walk to work together. So we walk to the train, which means walks to the train in Quincy, then ride it up in here. Then we spend a little time talking about that. And I think that's just because we got into a habit of it. The only time we talk science is when we're walking to work. Mostly at home, around the dinner table, we talk administrative issues connected with the department and not science. What's our feeling about maybe this new faculty hire? Or we discuss a problem student an issue connected with spending departmental money or what. So it's sort of that discussion. And then, of course, it all gets discussed at the next faculty meeting. But at least we know where each one of us feels about it, and it's an opportunity to test our opinion. So that's about where the extent of it. So she takes work home and does it in the. So I go to work most of the time. Earlier than she does, and then stay later. Because I do a lot of the work here, and whereas she's inclined to take stuff home, so we have a terminal there, and she spends a lot of time and does her reviewing and writing and letter compositions and whatever there, and I just do it here. So it's not that we're home all that much together. I don't get home till about 8 or 9 o'clock, and then she usually goes home about 5 or 6, and then I come to work about 5 or 6, and she comes to work about 9. But when I, so instead of working at home, then I spend a lot of time thinking at home. Sometimes in front of the TV, which is not the best one, but I'm kind of a firm believer that ideas are kind of like seeds that you in our, especially in that you kind of need to let them grow for a while and then look away from them, forget about them for a while, and then come back to them and think a little bit more about it. This, I think, sort of like, what's that term? Cows and horses, they have these multiple stomachs, they have this ruminants.
Yeah.
So you just kind of chewing on it all the time, you know, and then you put it aside, you know, don't they put that back in their stomach and then bring it back up again? Yeah, all right. So to me, that the best time to do that is in the evenings, you know, with just a pencil and a piece of paper at the most, and then just kind of write down things, and then this pad I have at home, and then I turn back to it and kind of refresh my memory. So that's the activity that I do at home in lieu of this paperwork or whatever.
Okay. Let me put this over real quick.